Welcome back. I see the front bench has now changed as we enter into agenda item 3, marine ecology. I think to kick off on this under item A is to understand particularly MMO's views on the application's compliance with the Eastern Shore and Offshore Marine plans.
So could I just interrupt on one thing before we launch in?
You have.
Having made my interruption, I request permission to interrupt. From this morning's proceedings and probably continuing on from now, I suspect there are going to be various actions which we identify that could include clarification notes and so on. We need to bear in mind, I think, firstly that we will be making a summary of our oral submissions of today within the due deadline. We will obviously be issuing clarification notes as requested or other follow-up notes, and there may also be written questions, and it would be very helpful perhaps at the end of today's proceedings if we can just have a rerun, if you like, of the actions from today, what form those actions are to take, whether it is a response to a written question, whether it is in the form of a clarification note, or whether it is something that we simply include in our summary of oral submissions, and also, of course, by what deadline, just so that we're all absolutely on all fours as to what's been requested and what we need to do. That would be most helpful to us if that's acceptable to you.
It is acceptable to us. We are compiling a running list of action items. Yesterday's should be published today. And hopefully the action items from today will be published very soon, and we will make sure that it's identified whether we're looking for a clarification note. Clarification notes we are looking for particular issues which we think are important to the examination and IEPs, rather than a response to the question. So yes, we will make clear what form we are looking for the response and by what deadline. And we also accept that deadline one isn't far away, but then again, you do have a lot of resources.
Thank you, duly noted. but would it be helpful also if we just did a quick run through verbally at the end of today so that everybody's understanding is clear, as it were, just so that we know what to expect.
Yes, the thing to do there is we won't be running through all the action points today at the end of the hearing, but we will, where we've asked for specific notes, we will be clear about what deadline. So I think we have probably two on the go at the moment, from recollection. But if there are other specific post-hearing notes, then we will be clear about deadlines. But as Mr. Braithwaite said, we'll publish our action points for today with a good wind behind us tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank you. Now, we can move on to item 3 and returning to MMO.
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. The MMO discussed the East Marine plans during the Norfolk Vanguard submission and suggested a checklist just to for the applicant to show how they were adhering to the policy. In the Norfolk Boreas submission, they have amended the policy and legislation chapter in relation to the East plans. However, we would still like and recommend a checklist to show how they'd adhere to each plan and whether each plan was scoped in or policy within the plan was scoped in or out.
Okay, thank you very much. So are you in the process of producing a checklist for the two marine plans?
If I could perhaps pass over to Mr. Tarrant on that one and just to respond.
David Tarrant on behalf of the applicant. Yes, we discussed this issue with the MMO earlier this week, and we will be submitting the checklist as they have requested.
And will that checklist be available by deadline one?
Yes, certainly we'll be able to provide that checklist by deadline one.
Thank you very much. Moving on to item B, to understand when the further seabed mobility studies would be completed and any potential impacts on biodiversity receptors. Again, this is in response to some of MMO's concerns in their relative representation. Can I ask the applicant if they would like to give a bit of background to this and the current position?
Again, sir, I'll pass over to Mr. Tarrant. Thank you.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. The seabed mobility studies have been completed, and we're just in the process of finalising the report for provision to the MMO. But I will just give a slight update on the evidence that is in that study, if that's possible.
Yes.
So the results of the study further support the evidence provided within the environmental statement and the information to support HRA. The findings, what the preliminary findings from that report were already integrated within the ES, and the final report only serves to confirm those initial findings. Therefore, the conclusions made in Chapter 8, which is marine geology, oceanography and physical processes, remain relevant. That's document 221 of the application. And the other chapters that lead on from the findings of that that chapter are also relevant as well. So in summary, the conclusions of that study only serve to support further the baseline conditions that were included within the original assessment.
Thank you for the update. Now, obviously, as the MMO haven't received that yet, I won't ask you to comment. Could you give us some idea of when that document will be entered into examination?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, yes, we can confirm that we will do that by deadline one.
Thank you very much. Then we await that, and then we'll await MMO's comments subsequent to that. So, move on to item C, to understand the risks associated with the conceptual model for the marine and coastal processes, in particular to HSWSAC, and also I would like to add in the chalk beds MCZ. Now, again, would the applicant like to give some background and present situation?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. I think it's probably best to break this one down into three separate points. The first is the conceptual model, and then if we look at impacts within the Norfolk Boreas site and those potential effects on the Haysbury-Hammond and Winterton SAC, and then the impacts that occur within the SAC themselves, if that's suitable.
Yes, that's fine, thanks.
So the conceptual model, as was used on East Anglia 3 and Norfolk Vanguard, was discussed and agreed through the evidence plan process for Norfolk Boreas. Is everybody familiar with the evidence plan process? This type of approach, so the conceptual model, was originally proposed and accepted for East Anglia 3 following a review of round 1 and round 2, and also East Anglia Offshore 1 wind farms. Several of those wind farms used a model approach and all concluded the same result, which was that there would be no significant effects on physical processes, and the magnitude of any effects would be very small. It was then reasoned that any modelling applied to other sites would also find the same or draw the same conclusions. The method statement presenting this conceptual approach was provided to the Norfolk Boreas Marine Physical Processes Expert Topic Group, which is part of the evidence plan process, in January 2018, and a method statement which is contained in Appendix 9.16 of the consultation report, which is APP 053 in the examination library. This was discussed and agreed in an expert topic group meeting in February 2018, and further comment was provided following that meeting by the MMO and Natural England in March of that year. We believe that the conceptual approach is fully justified, especially in regards to the distance of the Norfolk Boreas site from any sensitive receptors such as the HHW-SAC. It's also point to note that the location of the wind farm site is set over 70 kilometres from the coast, which is also identified as a sensitive receptor. The MMO do note in their relevant representation that there are limitations to the conceptual approach. However, they do conclude that although the impacts are defined qualitatively, the MMO do consider that the significant assessments to be generally reasonable. The applicant would agree with this statement and also point out that it is proportionate, as I mentioned, with the risk posed by the project to physical processes receptors and thereby also benthic ecology receptors.
Can I just pause you there and take you back? As you say, the MMO does say that the model is likely to be adequate. No dispute there, but goes on to say that it highlights that the assessment could be open to challenge if strong contradictory evidence such as detailed monitoring was presented elsewhere. Do you have any comments on that?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, I think the main response would be that at other wind farms which have taken the same approach, there has been no modelling presented that would dispute the original findings of the assessment.
That's understood, but do you accept that it is a risk if someone did provide detailed monitoring?
Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, yes, obviously there is a risk there, but we believe that that risk is very small due to the fact that the sensitive receptors are sufficiently distant from the Norfolk Boreas site to make that a larger risk.
Okay, thank you.
So then if we move on to the effects of physical processes within the wind farm site and how they might be manifested and whether they would affect the SAC. Within the site itself, that's where the greatest effects on physical processes would be. They'd be associated with the wind farm array. The main source of effect would be from the placement of foundations and the associated scour protection around those foundations. As demonstrated by the modelling completed at East Anglia 1, effects on the physical processes would be localised around each turbine, foundation or platform from an electrical platform. This would be true of both the sediment released as part of seabed levelling to provide a stable platform to install that foundation, or from physical effects of the foundations once they're in place. So effects on the wave, the tides, the currents, and sediment transport within the wind farm array. Modelling used for East Anglia 1 assessed a far greater release of sediment volume and larger structures than we have within our current design envelope. So I'd just like to make that point. And therefore, when applying the findings from the East Anglia 1 modelling to the Norfolk Boreas assessment, there is already a level of precaution built in because of the volumes in the disposal models at East Anglia 1 were for greater amounts of disposed sediment and the structures of the foundations themselves were larger than proposed in the Norfolk Boreas project design envelope. Do you have any further comments on impacts within the site?
Yes, just one again, the MMO did raise concerns about depths of sediments and the sediment lowering of sand waves by 9 metres. There was a query as whether there are still areas where sediment lowering would be occurring at that depth, and there are concerns about that.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, we think we've responded to this in our response to relevant reps, and we have confirmed in that response that we are no longer looking at any 9 metre sound waves. The maximum that we think we might need to interact with is of 5 metres. So that is in our response to relevant reps.
Thank you for that.
And also to point out, that would be within the cable, the export cable corridor, so it's not within the wind farm site.
Right. Okay.
So then if I take those impacts from within the site and build that into the cumulative impact assessment and therefore potential impacts on the Haysborough, Hammond and Winston SAC, I think it's important to note out that for waves and tidal currents, the zone of influence from Norfolk Boreas and Norfolk Vanguard and East Anglia 3, which are the closest potential wind farms and therefore the most pertinent to the cumulative impact assessment, are all aligned in a north-south or north-northwest to south-southwest direction. And the Haysborough, Hammond and Winston SAC is located 40 kilometres to the west of the Norfolk Boreas site. And the assessment demonstrates that the SAC is not intersected by any of those zones of influence of the three wind farms individually or when you overlap the zones of influence. This is because the cumulative effect would bypass effectively the Haysborough, Hammond and Winston SAC to its eastern side. If we now, so that's kind of dealt with the impacts within the wind farm and how they would cumulatively or not affect the Haysborough, Hammond and Winston SAC. And I'm now going to move on to impacts within the actual SAC itself, unless you have any further questions on the site.
No, please continue.
So the applicant has assessed the potential for cumulative effects of activities undertaken by Norfolk Boreas and Norfolk Vanguard within the SAC. The cable route for East Anglia 3, it was screened out because it's too far to the south to actually affect the SAC, in combination with the low level of effects that would be seen by Norfolk Boreas within the SAC and Norfolk Vanguard. So the magnitude of any impacts within the SAC would be far less than those within the wind farm site, because the scale of the infrastructure being placed is much smaller. If you kind of compare cable protection over a cable to a large foundation, the effects are of a much smaller magnitude. So the main effects within the SAC would be from sound wave levelling and, as I said, the cable protection. So we take both of those in turn. Firstly, the sound wave levelling that we're proposing as part of the potential cable installation process. The assessment was completed by Seawind to determine the amount of sediment which would be dredged as a result of the sound wave levelling, and that is Appendix 5.2 to the application, so that's document APP 548 within the library. And that report quantifies the amount of material that would be required for dredging of the sound waves for both projects, that's Norfolk Vanguard and Norfolk Boreas. And then this information was used in a separate study completed by ABP Mayor, which is Appendix 7.1 of the HRA, so that's Application Document 206, to assess what the effect of levelling would be on the sound waves within the SAC. Overall, the report concludes that the proposed bed levelling works are not considered likely to disrupt the form and function of the sound waves locally or at the sandbank system scale within the SAC, as these are governed by processes that occur over a much larger scale than the proposed works. The sound waves are expected to continue to evolve in response to natural regional scale processes, which will continue unaffected by the installation of the cables. Any questions, or do you want me to carry on?
No, go on.
And then if we take the installation of cable protection, the assessment in Chapter 8, which is APP 221, assesses the effects of placement of cable protection on physical processes. However, due to the small scale of the area occupied by the cable protection and the fact that the protection would only be up to 0.5 metres high in most situations, apart from where a cable crossing or where the cables have to cross the pipeline, in which case it would be 0.9 metres high. The assessment concludes that the effects on physical processes would be negligible.
Can I pause you there?
That's pretty much it.
Thank you. I know that the Inshore Fishermen's Association are concerned about cable laying, and in their representation, which I've forgotten the number of, Inshore Fishermen's Association, RR091, they have concerns about cable laying and disruption of sediment. Now, I don't know if EIFCA would like to make any comment on that, or would you prefer I went straight back to the applicant?
Sandra Cooper, Eastern Ithaca. I can understand the Inshore Fishermen's concerns with cable laying. I think we've had experience, particularly in our district, where cables have been buried, and unfortunately they haven't stayed buried, and I'm sure neither the wind farm companies nor the fishermen are happy about that situation. Obviously, whenever they become unburied, they cause a health and safety risk in terms of snagging of gear, and particularly with inshore vessels, they're very small, and that can cause vessels to capsize and potentially loss of life, so it's a very serious health and safety concern. Also, action that can be taken whenever reburial happens can be rock armouring and so on, and again, form a new habitat that's no longer suitable to fish, particularly trawl, over. So I can understand their concerns.
Yeah. Thank you. And can the applicant respond?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. Within our project design envelope, we've allowed for the ability to do the sound wave levelling, which we believe would then install the cables to a suitable depth where the sediment is not mobile, and therefore drastically reduce. We can't 100% rule out the chance that a cable would become exposed, but with that technology or that approach, we would be very, very confident that the cables would not become exposed. So that's the main mitigation point for cables becoming exposed.
Right, thank you. I'm sure the IFCA will respond to that. But now or would you like to respond in writing it?
Sandra Cooper, Eastern Ithaca. Yeah, it's reassuring to know that there's new technologies and that you're feeling very confident. I think time will tell, to be honest, and we would hope, very much hope, that that would be the case.
And MMO, do you have any comments on what you've heard?
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. We've been in discussion with the applicant since Norfolk Vanguard, and our continuing discussions. We're in discussions with our scientific advisors as well, in relation to the comments that the applicant has provided about the cable laying, and the other comments relating to the conceptual modelling as well. And we will respond to the applicant with those comments and provide responses to yourselves in time.
And I think what I'd like to understand, if there are still areas of disagreement between the two parties.
At the moment, yes, because I haven't spoken to the scientific advisors fully to understand if the applicant's comments have alleviated any concerns yet. And then we'll provide, if there is still ongoing discussions and concerns from that.
Because I'm also aware that there are concerns about cable protection and the types of protection. This is particularly to do with Annex 1 reefs.
There is multiple concerns, and I think Natural England have large concerns on that. Our concerns mainly new cable protection, and we support Natural England and what they say in relation to the cable protection being in place.
Okay, thank you very much. I think, again, it's a shame Natural England aren't here, but we'll carry on without them. Moving on to item D, to receive an update on the joint statement being prepared by MMO Oh, and an E on cable protection. Can you comment?
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. The joint position statement is going to provide guidance on how rock protection will be dealt with in the operations and maintenance phase. This is both within and without, and within and outside of designated sites. The MMO will be providing a supplementary document about the specifics in relation to marine licensing, and this will support the applicant's statement application, so this will help influence how they submit a new application. It also supports the applicant's statement that cable protection will be in a separate license. So we're in agreement with that won't be included. And the MMO are aware that Natural England have proposed this will be submitted at deadline 2, and we'll be working to the same time scale. And we just wanted to acknowledge that the replenishment of rock can be dealt with through the operation and maintenance plan, and our main concerns were new rock protection, which the applicant has agreed, so we're happy with that at the moment.
So again, just for clarity, when will the joint statement be introduced into the examination?
We are looking at deadline 2.
Deadline 2?
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Any comments from the applicant?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, no, I can confirm that what the MMO have just said is correct.
Thank you very much. And moving on then to item E, consider the effects on and recovery of sandbank features within the SAC of repeated replacement or reburial of cable and the need for monitoring. And again, I think this is something apart from the MMO, the Inshore Fishing Association would also be interested in.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. Again, I think I'd like to put forward a few points in relation to this agenda item and kind of split it up between the replacement, the reburial, and then the monitoring, if that's appreciated. During the lifetime of the project, it should be noted that there's no anticipation of scheduled repairs or replacement of subsea cables, so anything that would be done would be reactive to a cable becoming exposed or a fault in the cable. So we wouldn't anticipate that there would anything be scheduled to actually happen. However, inspections, periodic inspections would be necessary, and that's when we would identify whether a repair or replacement would be required. The worst case scenario for both cable repairs and cable reburial, as used in the EIA and indeed the HRA, are based on no sand wave levelling being permitted. So I talked earlier about the sand wave levelling and how we believe that is a way to, if not 100%, ensure that cables do not become exposed, certainly increase the likelihood of cables remaining buried for the duration of the project. But this, what I'm about to talk about now, the worst case scenarios are based on that not being permitted. So not burying cables to the optimum depth that we would like to. So if we take cable repairs first, it's not possible at the outset to determine the number and the location of any unscheduled repair works that may be required during the life of the project, a precautionary estimate of one export cable repair every 10 years on average within the SAC has been included within the environmental statement and also the information to support HRA. The worst case scenario used in this assessment, as I said, is based on the fact that sound wave levelling wouldn't have occurred. It's also, these numbers have been determined by Vattenfall's experience at other existing wind farms, some of which were installed in the early 2000s, and since then marine cables have become more reliable and the installation techniques more reliable as well. So the worst case scenarios have been developed and have been included within the ES and the HRA. Cable repairs would only be for, or the worst case scenario is that cable repairs would only be for short section of cable, no more than 300 metres in length, and therefore the overall area impacted within the SAC would be very small. A figure of 0.003 kilometres squared is being calculated based on the worst case scenario. In terms of cable reburial, cable repairs, again, the aim would be to bury the cables as to the optimum level, and therefore the sound wave levelling would have occurred, and this would avoid the requirement to rebury your cables. The information to support HRA considers the worst case scenario against cables that become exposed, and based on this scenario, the sound wave levelling pre-sweeping had not been installed. Reburial of up to 4 kilometres of cable within the SAC is the worst case scenario that we've assessed, occurring approximately every 5 years. This has been estimated and used in the ES and the HRA. As noted in the HRA, this is a very precautionary approach, and we believe that the actual sections of cables likely to require repair would be more likely to be up to 1 kilometre. Using this precautionary worst-case scenario within the HRA and the EIA, the area of disturbance that would occur as a result of reburial would equate to 0.03% of the total area of the SAC and 0.07% of the total area of sandbank which has been identified within the SAC. The reburial process would not result in any sediment leaving the SAC, and therefore the sandbanks would rapidly recover with no lasting loss of formal function. Therefore, the information to support HRA concludes that there will be no adverse effect on integrity of the sandbanks as a result of the maintenance operations. The areas where export cables are most likely to become exposed would be in the most mobile sediment. These areas are characterised by low-diversity benthic communities, which would rapidly recolonise the affected area, and this type of habitat does not support the Sabularia spinulosa reef, which is the other feature of the SAC, as that requires a more stable substrate to be able to establish reef. In order to limit as far as possible the amount of cable protection that would be located within the SAC, Norfolk Boreas Limited have made the commitment, and this is, although it was kind of assumed in the environmental impact assessment, this is a commitment that we've fully made now following the application, to always attempt to rebury cables which become exposed before installing cable protection on those cables. And also, as the MMO pointed out earlier, we've also confirmed that any additional area of cable protection would require a separate marine license at that time when the cable had become unburied. So we've made the appropriate changes in the offshore operations and maintenance plan, which is document 811, so in the examination library 702 of the application, and we've agreed those changes with the MMO. Would you like me to come on to monitoring now, or have you got
questions? Yes, please.
Yeah. So in terms of monitoring, the proposed monitoring at present is outlined within the outline Haysborough, Hammond and Winston, SIP, which is document reference APP 711 in the examination library. However, it's recognised that the full monitoring will be detailed within the final HHW SIP, and this will be agreed with the MMO in consultation with Natural England prior to construction. And the final proposals for monitoring would be agreed and outlined within that document. Currently, in the outline Haysborough, Hammond and Winston SIP, we propose a full pre-construction geophysical survey, which would include a buffer of 500 metres around any of the works proposed within the SAC, and then a geophysical post-construction survey, which would be within the areas where the works have been undertaken. If after the post-construction survey sandbanks have not been shown to at least start to recover, further surveys would be agreed with the MMO to further monitor the recovery of the sandbanks. And the last thing is that It should be noted that the results of the Norfolk Vanguard pre-construction and post-construction surveys would also inform our approach to the monitoring.
Can I just, for my clarity, can you remind me how often your inspections of the cable routes would be? Which is slightly different from monitoring, I know, but you did say earlier on that you'd be inspecting the cables for damage.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not entirely sure of how often and frequently they would be, but I believe them to be unintrusive monitoring operations, so not contact the seabed and not, therefore, no impacts have been assessed on that.
So can, within your response to this question, which will probably end up as a written question, if you could clarify the number, the frequency of inspections.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, I believe that there would be internal systems within the cables that monitor any fault or identify any fault. I think that this is also in reference to the potential to undertake a visual inspection with an ROV, but not to contact the seabed in any way, shape or form. Mm.
Yeah, I think, again, we will put this down as a first written question and get you a considered response.
Unless amongst you there is somebody that is able to answer the question, I do see quite a few people sitting in the room.
We think it's probably Mr. Driver, who isn't here today, who can give a definitive answer on that one. So perhaps it's better deferred for a response to a WQ.
Okay. MMO, do you have comments?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. We have not, we're still in discussions with our scientific advisors from the comments received back to our relevant rep, so we haven't got further comments at this time, but we will carry on the discussions with the applicant beforehand and provide updates in our responses.
Okay, thank you very much. In that case, can we move on to item F, to consider the need for hydrodynamic modelling for sediment disposal as a result of dredging. And again, this was a comment, a requirement from MMO. So would the applicant like to respond?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. I think I'd like to break this down into the two types of that maybe is maybe being considered, or the two types of sediment disposal that would relate to monitoring. So sediment disposal would occur as a result of seabed levelling for foundation placement, and it would also result in the occasion where sand wave levelling would be required to install cables. So there's two slightly different dredging activities required. Both of these activities would occur within the North Boroughs site. However, it would only be the sand wave levelling that would occur in the offshore cable corridor, so where the export cables are being installed. So if we take the site first of all. As described in Chapter 8 of the ES, which is document reference 221 in the library, the assessment uses modelling simulations undertaken for East Anglia 1, as I previously mentioned, under item C, and those are used as a proxy for the Norfolk Boroughs project. And the simulations for East Anglia 1 were conducted by ABP Mayor using a Delft 3D plume model. The proxy model we feel is justified because the sediment characteristics are largely similar within the East Anglia 1 site and the Norfolk Boroughs site, and the modelling for East Anglia 1 used a maximum daily release of 22,500 metres cubed of sediment. The estimated maximum release of sediment due to seabed levelling for foundations within the Norfolk Boroughs site is less than that. It's 14,137 metres cubed. and therefore there's an amount of leeway within that model, and therefore the approach is considered conservative. The results of the modelling at East Anglia One showed that for the most part the deposited layer of sediment across the wider seabed would be less than 0.2 millimetres thick and would not exceed 2 millimetres at any 2 millimetres at thickness at any location. As described in Chapter 8, Marine Geology, Oceanography and Physical Processes, no sensitive receptors were identified within the Norfolk Boreas site in terms of physical processes, and further, in Chapter 10, Benthic Ecology, APP 223, the benthic surveys for the Norfolk Boreas site did not identify any sensitive features apart from a couple of areas of Sabularia Reef, which would be avoided through micro-siting of infrastructure. Therefore, only minor impacts on benthic ecology were predicted. As a result, no additional mitigation such as the modelling of hydrodynamic processes is proposed. It should also be noted that the approach of using the modelling that was conducted at East Anglia One as a proxy was also agreed through the evidence plan process, and this approach was also used for East Anglia Three and Norfolk Vanguard, with the latter being closer to sensitive features. So in conclusion on the site, the applicant maintained that a proxy model is appropriate and proportionate to the magnitude of the impacts, and would, especially given the distance from any sensitive features. Therefore, no hydrodynamic modelling is required either to inform the EIA and HRA or as a future mitigation measure.
Okay, thank you for that. If we could turn to MMO. Two questions. First of all, are you content that the East Anglia One model is appropriate? And secondly, are you content that there is no need for further modelling?
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. We are still in discussions with our scientific advisors, that is. So to get further comments on the applicant's response, so there was discussions during the evidence plan process and it was agreed, and then there's further comments have come out in the relevant rep. So we've gone back to ask where these comments have come from, if it's further evidence or something else, and we'll have the discussions with the applicant and provide updates either way when we get them.
And provide updates by?
Definitely deadline two, but I'm hoping deadline one. In detail, because of the discussion, we're going to have discussions next week with the applicant. So,
Seems to me that a lot of these are kind of questions that we will include within our first written questions published next week. And then, if we've addressed them, as we did with the draft development consent order yesterday, if we've addressed them during the course of the hearing, then we'd ask you to indicate that and then to point us to the relevant document. But if not, if they're going out as first written questions, then we would expect everything to come back by deadline two, which is currently the 10th of December, just so there's no misunderstanding. So it would be deadline two if it goes into the first written question, which in this case probably sounds like it is.
So it gives you a little bit time. Yes, the applicant.
David Tarrant on behalf of the applicant. Another mechanism by agreeing this is through the Statement of Common Ground as well, and we're in discussions as most of the clarifications that we've asked for are related to the current position in the Statements of Common Ground as well. So as that information comes in, then hopefully we will be able to resolve the Statements of Common Ground on those specific points.
Can I just comment on the fact that it's good to hear that you are in active discussions and that things are moving forward, and that is appreciated. In that case, we can move on to item G. Now, there has been a lot of discussion within the relevant reps and the responses about the Annex 1 reefs. And in particular, now this is Natural England have got concerns about the modelling for sediment disposal of, about the approach to Sabularia spinulosa reef mapping and assessment. Now, is it possible for the applicant to provide an update on the current situation?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. If I give a bit of background to the mapping approach that we've taken,
yes.
And then go from there. So the benthic survey method for the actual survey itself was agreed with Natural England and the MMO in 2016, and this is referring to the survey of the cable corridor and therefore the bit within the SEC. The method included geophysical data collection, ground truthing by grab sampling and by drop-down video where grab sampling could not be completed. Hugo, who undertook the survey, then produced a biotope map primarily using the geophysical data. Biotope of Sabularia spinulosa on stable circulatural mixed sediment was identified as potentially being present within that biotope map. However, we did agree with Natural England as part of the evidence pound process that the Sabularia biotope doesn't automatically infer that there would be Sabularia reef there, but it does give an indication that reef potentially could develop. Therefore, because of that risk, we then contracted Envision Mapping Limited to undertake further investigation of the potential extent of Sabularia reef within the area of the cable corridor, which overlaps with the SEC. It should be pointed out that Envision are leading experts in the field of identifying Sabularia reef, including the mapping of its extent. For example, they prepared the OSPAR background document on Sabularia spinulosa reefs. They've also contributed to the LIMPENI methods for mapping Sabularia reef. And that'll be pertinent because I'll come on to that in a bit. But any questions on that?
So what's the current situation between yourselves and Natural England?
The current situation is that there's two maps being produced. The map that we produce is based on the individual actual locations of Sabularia spinulosa reef, whereas the map produced by Natural England and the JNCC, although they use very similar methods at the outset as a starting point, the mapping produced by Natural England and the JNCC is for areas to be managed as Sabularia reef. So these areas are not known Sabularia reef at the moment. The difficulty is that there are very few surveys that actually target exact mapping of the Sabularia reef. So there has to be some kind of inference from other data to work out where you think the areas of Sabularia reef actually occur. And the maps that Natural England and JNCC have produced are maps of areas to be managed as Sabularia reef. Now the two maps, and this has been agreed with Natural England, do concord fairly well in certain areas. There are other areas where they don't concord quite as well in, but generally the maps are highlighting the same areas. So that's an update on the position as where where I believe we are with Natural England at this point.
Thank you for that. And again, outside of the hearings, are you still in frequent contact with Natural England?
The last meeting we had with them was on the 21st of October, where we got the statement of common ground to the point that it is today. It's becoming quite difficult to organise meetings with them, but yes, we are in correspondence with Natural England.
Well, we obviously encourage you to do as much as you can to resolve these issues. I would just like to ask MMO, do you have any comments on the reef mapping process?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. Our scientific advisors in our relevant rep, we did mention the reefing to see if it, and we've gone back to clarify if it was the JNCC and Natural England mapping that they were referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get back, we are in discussions. I think the applicant and myself are in agreement that it probably is that, but we've gone to clarify and see that it is. we'll provide update.
Can I just explore what you mean about it's quite difficult to have meetings with Natural England? Just let me understand what that really means.
I think, David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicants, I think it's just in their availability and getting meetings organised in a timely manner.
What does that really mean?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant, I think the way to take this forward is we will endeavour to do as much as we can to organise meetings and progress issues.
So, not wanting to push this too much, but I will. I think the message that we're getting is that you're willing to cooperate and discuss, but you're having problems getting a response or getting getting a response back from Natural England, maybe because of their, let's say, their time pressures.
So I think the short answer to that is yes. And we appreciate Natural England have got resource issues, but it is a continuing issue that we are encountering with them. And also, of course, the continuing issue is demonstrated today by the fact that they're not here.
It is a concern to the examination because obviously we aren't getting resolutions to fairly important issues. We'll not push you any further on that. but then if we can move on to item H, where again the MMO have raised the issue of maybe needing a license condition for releasing sediments. And there's this the dispute about distances. MMO, would you like to comment further?
So, at risk of being accused of interrupting yet again, there's a further point that Mr. Tarrant wanted to make about further, as it were, survey work to improve the level of certainty on this issue of mapping. If he might make that point as well.
Thank you for that. Yes.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. I think it's mainly because we've had a lot of discussions with Natural England regarding the different mapping approaches that have been undertaken, and there's some level of disagreement in the methodologies used. But we kind of both confer that they are saying a similar thing. But we propose that the way to take this forward is to undertake further survey in 2020. Unfortunately, it won't be in time to feed into the examination process. But we think that because of the elevated level of risk that has now been introduced or perceived by Natural England, that we think the way to move this forward is to undertake further survey in 2020 to map using methods that are particularly targeted at mapping Sable Area Reef and undertake those surveys in 2020 to get the latest kind of opinion of what is included within the Hayes Bramden Winter site. But that is just the area of the cable corridor which overlaps with the SEC.
I appreciate it does take time to organise these surveys, but it's a little unfortunate that it will not be able to be introduced in, the results won't be able to introduce into the examination.
One of the main reasons for proposing that we undertake this survey, and we have been progressing things to get that survey organised, is because of the relevant representation and the evolution of advice that has been provided within that relevant representation from what we had previously discussed with Natural England. So therefore, it's obviously elevated it in our minds, and therefore we propose to undertake this survey. And I think this does relate and weave into the site integrity plan and the issues that Natural England are concerned that if we just were to rely on a pre-construction survey, which would only be undertaken 12 months before the installation of the cables would actually occur, we would need data prior to that to start doing the planning of the cable route and procuring cables and things like that. So we'd need that information earlier. So we're proposing to introduce this further interim survey. Obviously, the pre-construction surveys would still be used to do the fine detail and last-minute tweaking as to where Sabal area had established at that point. But the interim survey is proposed as a way of reducing the risk and giving both parties more confidence in our definition of where the actual Sabal area reef is.
Okay, I appreciate maybe coming up later on, but I appreciate that there are issues with the site integrity plans, and we'll pick that up shortly.
Yep.
But thank you for that clarification. MMO.
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. In relation to the release and sediments at 50 metres, I am still in discussion with the scientific advisers. As we all were, this was agreed with Natural England. We've welcomed the addition of the fall pipe and possible changes to the site integrity plan, which will go on later by the applicant. We've had discussions with the applicant, so these will still be ongoing as a number of the other agenda points.
Okay, thank you for that. Any comments from the applicant?
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. It's just to go over the point that the MMO have just made. We have, as a result of these comments in the relevant representations of both the MMO and Natural England, have committed to disposing of any sediment within the SAC by the use of a full pipe from the dredge vessel, which will mean that we will be more confident in the destination of that sediment and its ability to avoid the Sabal area reef. That, to be clear, that's an additional mitigation measure that we hadn't put within the environmental impact assessment or the habitats regulations assessment, but we do propose to update the SIT document with that mitigation to secure it.
The inevitable question is, when will you be providing the updated SIP?
We will provide the updated SIP at deadline one.
Thank you very much. And now I'd like to move on to sand eels. And the need for considering the cumulative effect on sand eels and the need for post-construction habitat assessment. Would you like to comment, MMO?
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. My comment is we don't have any further comments. We have been in discussion and we have got a lot of information from the applicant that I've passed to the scientific advisers to have a discussion. And I have spoken to the applicant earlier in the week, and we're possibly going to arrange a call to discuss it all rather than go back and forth and have those discussions through writing continuously to try and iron the concerns out.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And any response from the applicant?
Sara Chiguanova, on behalf of the applicant. Sara Chiguanova, on behalf of the applicant, to highlight that discussions are ongoing and we are hoping to resolve this issue through the Statement of Common Ground. If it's of any benefit, we can provide a summary of aspects that we consider are of key relevance in relation to the assessment of sand eels that we have discussed with the MMO previously.
I think that would be helpful.
Yep. So the applicant's position in relation to assessment of cumulative impacts on sand eels and key aspects that we feel are of relevance to the assessment include, in the first place, the fact that loss of habitat associated with offshore wind farm development is relatively small, being limited to the localized areas where infrastructure is placed, just foundations and localized areas where cable protection may be used, rather than being a loss of habitat across the entirety of any offshore wind farm project that you are considering in the impact assessment. We would also like to highlight that evidence from post-construction monitoring undertaken in offshore wind farms, where sand hills are a key component of the fish assemblage, suggests that the introduction of infrastructure associated with offshore wind farms is too small to influence the abundance of sand-dwelling species such as sand hills. And this would also apply in a cumulative context, and therefore, to a large extent, it could negate the potential for a significant additive loss of grounds to occur on that species. In relation to cumulative impacts, we would also like to highlight the small potential contribution of the Norfolk Boreas project to the overall cumulative impact. And as presented in the ES in Chapter 11, Fish and Shellfish Ecology, evidence from the distribution of known spawning and nursery grounds for sandhills, which are understood to a large extent mirror the distribution of adults, suggests that the area of Boreas is not of key importance to sandhills. This is also in line with evidence from the distribution of the sandhill fishery in the North Sea, as derived from VMS data from the Danish sandhill fishery, and also in line with known mapping of sandhill grounds in the North Sea. Therefore, we feel that the contribution of Boreas being an area not of key importance to sandhills would be extremely small. Also of relevance in relation to cumulative impacts, the MMO have suggested in their comments that the area of the project may become important for sandhills as other areas become unavailable in the future, and that this should have been taken account of in the cumulative assessment. In relation to this, we would like to highlight that the assessment we undertook takes account of the existing baseline as identified in the technical report, and it is not really possible to attempt to predict the distribution of sand hills in the North Sea and areas which may be colonized in the future. And also in this context, I think it's highly relevant to highlight that sand hills display very high site fidelity, and they only undertake short distance movements. So once settled, adult individuals rarely disperse over more than tens of kilometers. Therefore, considering the relatively low expected numbers of sand hills in the area and the lack of key sand hill grounds in the proximity of Boreas, we do feel that it's highly unlikely that there could be potential for any colonization of the Boreas site in the future in any significant levels.
Thank you for that clarification. I think all I can say is I hear what you say, and we await the conclusions of your discussions with MMO, but thank you for the clarification. Now, moving on to the site integrity plans. Now, again, there has been a lot of discussion about site integrity plans and their appropriateness in various representations. I know both MMO and Natural England have had made various representations. I think, could I turn to the applicant for its latest position?
Thank you, sir. I'll ask my colleague Victoria Redmond to address this topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria Redmond, on behalf of the applicant. I think the I'll obviously let you ask Natural England and the MMA their perspective on this, but from the applicant's perspective, the key concern of both the MMO and Natural England links to the condition as opposed to the mitigation in the plans. So their concern is more one to do with the wording of the actual condition in the DML as opposed to what is contained in the plans. I think they have some extra mitigation that they might want in, for example, the Haysborough, Hammond and Winterton plan. But that aside, generally, I think they're happy with the concept of a plan. It's more the way it's introduced through the condition in the DML is their concern. So just to give you the references in case they're useful, the Southern North CSIP is dealt with at condition 14.1M of the generation licence DMLs, which is schedules 9 and 10. And that's also covered in the transmission licence schedules, which is 11 and 12, at condition 9.1L. And the condition for the Haysborough, Hammond and Winterton SIP is only dealt with in the transmission licences because it only affects that area. So that's schedules 11 and 12, and it's condition 9.1M. And what that, without pulling it up, what that condition effectively says is it requires the MMO to be satisfied that the plan provides mitigation necessary to avoid adverse effect on integrity. And it's really that point that they are, I think, unhappy with, the fact that they would have to ask themselves that question when they receive the final plan as to whether it does enough to avoid adverse effect on integrity. That I think that's the crux of the concern. So in terms of the dealing with them one by one, the Southern North Sea site integrity plan first, I think that one is more accepted by both Natural England and the MMO. It has been endorsed by the Secretary of State on the East Anglia 3 decision, so it is a condition in the East Anglia 3 DMLs. It was also endorsed by the Secretary of State on the review of consents or the draft that they issued for consultation following the designation of the Southern North Sea SAC. And I think that that Natural England's and principally actually the MMO's concerns in relation to that plan relate to how they will be able to manage multiple projects in terms of the in combination impacts through the plan. So it's more of a practical aspect of how that plan can actually be put into practice. From the applicant's point, that is not something that is in the control of the applicant. That needs to be dealt with through a strategic regulator approach. So we do think the MMO are the right people to regulate that, and we do think that the SIP approach is the right approach to deal with that. So that's effectively, I think, where we are on the Southern North Sea plan. On the Haysborough, Hammond and Winterton plan, the first point that I think that we would make as the applicant is that we are not reliant on the condition as a way to avoid adverse effect on integrity. The applicant's position is that we can undertake that appropriate assessment now, and if we do so with the mitigation that's in the plan without that condition, we can avoid adverse effect on integrity. So we are not trying to put off the consideration of adverse effect on integrity to a later time. That's not what we are trying to do, and I'll come on to the reasons why we suggested it as an approach in this case, which was particularly to address some concerns of Natural England. So the reason the SIP was introduced in this particular case was particularly due to the ephemeral nature of the Sabal area. So Natural England's concerns were that it is not clear at the moment where the Sabal area is, but more importantly, it's not clear where it may be at the point at which the cable laying and cable protection will be undertaken. The intention of including this condition was really to provide a mechanism to give Natural England some comfort that at the point at which that further detail had been identified, the exact position of the cables was known, the exact proposal for cable protection was known, but most importantly, once we knew exactly where the Sabal area was, they would be able to effectively reassess the position and make sure that the commitments that we'd already given and the assessment that was undertaken at the point in time at the examination through the Secretary of State's decision still stood. So it was more of a validation from our perspective rather than a putting off of the appropriate assessment. So I think that the intention on our part was really to give some control and some comfort to Natural England in offering the condition and the plan. I think they generally welcome the mitigation that is in the plan, and I think they acknowledge it is detailed and it does go into go much further than I think some other plans have gone in the past. But I think their concern relates more to the fact that they will need to reconsider adverse effect at this later point in time. That's our understanding and our position.
Thank you very much for that. And presumably this is what Mr. Tarrant was suggesting while you're doing additional pre-commencement surveys.
David Tarrant, on behalf of the applicant. Yes, precisely. And there's another kind of suite of mitigation measures that we've also we'll also be proposing in the updated SIP as well to further allay certain concerns about various issues. I can go through those now if you'd like me to outline them, or we can come on to it at another point.
Carry on.
So I'd just like, summarise that I have mentioned a few of the additional mitigation measures in my previous points, but just to summarise in total the new kind of mitigation measures that will be proposed within the updated site integrity plan. So the first one is the commitment to dispose of sediment in a linear strip close to the cable route. Now, this is in response to a number of points that Natural England have made in their relevant representation, advising the applicant that the best method of disposing of any material from sound wave levelling would be as close to the area that it was dredged from. Now, we have talked about, or we assess the possibility of disposing material along the cable route or in a defined site within the SAC. We make the commitment fully that no sediment would be removed from the SAC. Everything would be disposed of back within the SAC. That commitment was already made, but we're further making a commitment to dispose of material very close to where it was dredged, essentially. So we propose to commit to disposing of material in a linear strip along the cable route rather than at the defined location. Disposing of sediment material immediately upstream or updrift of where that material was dredged from to aid the process of infill and recovery of the sandbanks. As I mentioned previously, disposing of the seabed material via a full pipe, which would mean that we're in more control of the destination of that sediment. The point about the survey in 2020, which I've already mentioned. We've also, there's a point in their relevant rep, Natural England's relevant rep, where they talk about mitigation measures that other projects have used within the SAC, and especially the use of material for a jack-up vessel where the footprint of the jack-up vessel would be on the same footprint as previously, or on material that's put on the seabed to prevent the impact of the jack-up. But we're going to make the commitment that we will not use jack-up vessels within the SAC, so therefore mitigating any impacts that could be caused by those sorts of vessels. And the final one is a commitment, as I've already mentioned, to prior to getting a marine license, to install any cable protection for a cable that becomes unburied, we will make the commitment to try and rebury that cable first before any further license was applied for any cable protection where it's become unburied. I'd also like to point out that we are providing a bit more clarity around where the cable, we expect the cable protection would likely to B within the SAC, and this is going to be submitted along with the updated site integrity plan as an appendix to that plan at deadline one, and that uses work that's been done to determine the amount of cable protection that we would expect due to unburied cables within the SAC, and it's looking at the areas where that study found that cable installation to the optimum depth may be difficult, and therefore that's the high-risk areas of where cable protection might be placed. So we're using that information to then do a further assessment of a quantitative assessment of where that may overlap with certain biotopes, certain features. Now, this is in response to Natural England's relevant representation, it's Appendix 2.5 of their relevant representation, and that requests further assessment to be done, and we are proposing to do that in response to that request, and that will be part of the updated site integrity plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. That was very helpful. Now, I'd like to turn to MMO, hearing what Ms. Redman was saying, I do remember that in your relevant rep, you do mention the appropriateness of using a SIP. So I'd just like to confirm that, or otherwise, whether you think that the SIP, as now described, is appropriate, and what the MMO's position is.
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. The MMO welcomes the amendments and commitments that the applicant has put forward, and we will review these and provide any comments. We still maintain the position that the concept of a SIP was designed to deal with in combination impacts. So it was designed for the Southern North Sea and the areas, and the lack of a mechanism. So the SIP was brought in for us to enable to have that mechanism to control it. So we have concerns in widening the use of the SIP to deal with project-only impacts. It's not something that we would support. The MMO are aware of the disagreement that there is currently about the adverse effect on integrity between the applicant and Natural England. And would say that if Natural England are advising that there is an adverse effect on integrity, then the MMO would require this to be fully considered at consent and stage rather at post-consent when the SIP was submitted. So we've discussed this in detail in our relevant rep, so I don't want to go into too much detail, but yeah, we will review the further details, but we are still concerned in relation to the appropriateness of the SIP.
Thank you for that. And I think, again, we can't progress the discussion much further without hearing Natural England's response. But it does sound as though this is an area of concern between yourselves and Natural England. And hopefully it's something which I'm sure you are actively discussing along with Natural England.
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. Yeah, we're still in discussions, and I think depend on the outcomes of the discussions on the updates depends on how Natural England's view, if it does change. But we still think opening it up to use a SIP for alone projects could cause issues. We don't really want a consented project to then have to possibly look at alternatives, compensation, IROB, at a later stage. We think that should be done at the consent and stage of the process, not post-consent.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Any response from?
So if I could just make 2 points.
Sure.
Firstly, that in the statement of common ground on Norfolk Vanguard with Natural England, as I understand it, at least, Natural England were at the point then of saying that the SIP approach and the SIP mechanism did allow a decision to be made on AEOI at the consenting stage. Now, I may have got that wrong, or I may be misinterpreting. That's what it appears to say. So if that, if I'm right on that, the line they seem to be taking now is a different one. The second point is that we have had some detailed discussions or telephone conversations with Natural England on this whole issue recently, and when you ask as to whether this is being progressed, we are doing our best to progress it, but from the responses we've had so far, we're uncertain at the moment as to whether we're likely to get any further with this issue, if you like, by agreement with Natural England.
And is that on the basis of Natural England taking a position, or the fact that it's lack of getting communication?
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. I think that we had quite lengthy discussions on this whole issue previously, and we hoped that we had got to a point where we had been able to accommodate Natural England's concerns by introducing the SIP. It appears now that those concerns, perhaps they have additional concerns or new concerns that they didn't have previously. I think it might be very hard to deal with those concerns without dealing with the crux of issues around being able to understand where you can lay cables without knowing where the saddle area might be in the future. I think that that's a particular issue that we were trying to address through the condition that we attached to the SIP. And around the certainty of matters such as laying cable protection. I know that Natural England were particularly concerned about cable protection in the area to be managed as reef. And that there are some particular concerns. It is unfortunate that Natural England are not here today, because I am aware that they have some particular concerns around matters such as the definition of the Annex 1 saddle area. And it would have been useful to explore those issues in some more detail. I think as the applicant, it's difficult where to go next to try and reach agreement on this. But we will do our best. We will try to progress matters. But I think we are struggling somewhat because we have taken matters to what we felt was as far as we could get. And we now need to find a new way to deal with the new concerns that have been raised.
Is this a warning shot that this may be something which you cannot resolve with Natural England, and we may need to make a decision?
It's possible, but as my colleague says, we feel we may need to try and approach it in a different way now. And if, for example, the issue is about the actual wording of the condition and the way it's approached there, and we can somehow find a way of rejigging that condition, perhaps, so that there are no specific references to adverse effect, and it is... The condition is approached perhaps in a similar way to what were frequent conditions in the past, which referred to Annex 1 habitat, where there would be a condition included in demarine licenses, which simply said that before start of construction, the applicant will conduct a pre-construction survey to establish whether or not there is an increase or the emergence of Annex 1 species that weren't there before, and in the event that they find that there are, they will discuss with the statutory bodies how to approach that problem. Now, in many ways, this whole SIP mechanism is a development of that approach, and so arguably, if there was a condition which simply said the SIP will be presented and approved by the MMO, and the development will be carried out in accordance with the agreed SIP, that might be the end of the story. So if maybe we can explore this with both Natural England and MMO and see whether that's a way of removing the concerns. But as of now, as we said, it's not proving an easy way forward, shall we say.
I think, well, obviously we can't take the debate forward without Natural England's presence. And I think the best approach for us is to include this as a first written question, so that we can be sure of getting a response from all parties. In the meantime, I'm sure you will be trying to continue to your discussions with Natural England, whichever approach you take to try and get a resolution. I think that's as far as we can go at the moment. Any final comments from MMO? Or no? Thank you very much. In that case, can we move on to marine mammals? And again, MMO have expressed concerns about continuous noise impacts on marine mammals, not just from piling, but from other construction activities. Would the applicant like to provide an update on position?
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Yes, a memorandum of understanding.
I think my colleague was anticipating that we were into item L. We've still got K to deal with.
Yep.
I think we'll hand over to Dave Tarrant and Jen Learmonth to deal with this topic.
Well, thank you.
Jennifer Learmonth on behalf of the applicant. We believe this comment is in regard to a statement with the MMO statement of common ground, where the questions using impulsive criteria modelling for other non-piling construction activities which are continuous sources. And our response to this is that the impulsive criteria are stricter than the non-impulsive continuous criteria. All of the results for the continuous noise using the impulsive criteria are low, and this is for construction activities other than piling. And the range is calculated using the non-pulse continuous criteria would therefore be much smaller than those modelled. So we have used a very precautionary approach. It has been agreed that the modelling used was appropriate, the thresholds and criteria follow current guidance and recommendations, and we have therefore used a very precautionary approach. So I think this is a point of clarification rather than a point of concern, and we don't see it as an issue going forward.
Thank you for that, and obviously I'd like to hear MMO's response.
Rebecca Reid, the MMO. We've sent the clarifications to the scientific advisers, so that'll be another point that will come back to advise either way if we still have concerns or not from the applicant's comments.
Not wanting to put you on the spot, but are you aware of ongoing concerns, or do you think this is something which is going to be resolvable?
I hope it is resolved. It seems the applicant's response seems to have covered what was asked. So I think they've clarified asked for clarifications as well. Mm. So I'm hoping it's the wording of the way it's been provided to ourselves. I'm hoping it'll be an easy one to
resolve.
Yeah.
And when do you think we may be seeing something?
Part of the statement of common ground for deadline two.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Can we now move on to item L? Ms. Redman.
Thank you very much, Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant. Yes, in relation to the memorandum of understanding between the applicant and the Wildlife Trust, a memorandum of understanding has been sent to the Wildlife Trust, and that is in relation not just to the Norfolk Boreas project, but in relation to all Vattenfall projects. We are waiting for comments from the Wildlife Trust on the Memorandum of Understanding, and I understand that a meeting is being arranged for late November to progress matters. In relation to what it covers, it covers general engagement between Vattenfall on their projects with the Wildlife Trust. What it doesn't cover is EPS injury and disturbance licences. In relation to, just to make the point, I think this is the point that is being raised, in relation to UXO and a licence for UXO and therefore mitigation, a triple MP for UXO, whilst we have assessed UXO in the application, we don't know the detail in order to be able to consent it at this stage. So we will be consenting it later, post any decision on this application, and at that point obviously the mitigation, the triple MP for UXO, will be developed. So at this stage it's not possible to consent it because the detail of what is needed is not known. That will be developed later, as would a triple MP for the UXO.
Okay, thank you for that update. I'm trying, November, would that be in time for deadline two, do you think?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, we'll attempt to do that. Obviously, it will depend on availability of
sure.
the Wildlife Trust and so on. I'm not sure exactly when the meeting has been set or if indeed a date has been agreed with them yet, but we'll do our best to progress matters as quickly as possible before deadline two.
Right. Thank you very much for that. Now, that comes to the end of the agenda as it is on this screen, but I just have one more comment. In Eni's relevant representation, they said that they would welcome further discussion with the applicant on the conclusion of no AE on integrity of the Humber Estuary SAC. Is that something, is that discussion continuing?
Jennifer Lermonth, on behalf of the applicant, this has been discussed and is ongoing, and we think it's something we can resolve through the statements of common ground.
Sorry, it's resolved, did you say?
We hope to take that forward with the statements of common ground and get that agreed.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. That takes us to the end. Unless there are any more comments or uncertainties about offshore marine? No? In that case, it's 1:05. It seems an appropriate place to stop for lunch. Can I suggest that we return at 2:05, and then you can have your ornithological front bench. Thank you.